And let's see. Welcome back to Shmuel Shaul Yehonatan. And what is still a bit of a mess as we try to figure this out. Yonatan's test that he set up. Again, remember the story. Shaul is Melech. Shaul is king. He has been anointed. He has been coronated. The people have accepted him as king. He's won his first battle. And everything is supposed to be good. And then Yonatan goes and kills the Plishti consul, representative of the Plishti government in the area. Unclear exactly what he was thinking or whether this was even his own initiative. The people assume that it's at Shaul's command. The people first rally for war. The Plishtim come out in greater force. The people panic and they flee. And the Plishtim are ready to attack. And then, as we saw last time, Yonatan crosses over from the south side of the Jewish camp to the north side of the Jewish camp, opposite where the Plishtim, the Philistines, are, and is ready to attack, and actually does attack. We noted that he did not tell anybody that he was doing this. He did not notify his father. He did not ask the advice of God via the Urim V'Tumim. He simply goes. And we had a different views as to why. One approach was that when he first went, he wasn't actually planning to attack. He just wanted to go see what was going on. That was Malbim. However, others seem to indicate that no, he specifically doesn't want anybody to know. Again, without an explanation for why he doesn't want anybody to know. It could be he doesn't want anybody to know because he believes this will make him more effective, that it's sort of just him and his armor bearer and no big force. It could be that he wants to create some nace, some miracle, which will be greater if it's just the two of them. It could be that it's because he wants the people to be able to sort of write this off as a lone wolf, right? Meaning, remember, we learned Shoftim, we learned about Shimshon, and we said that Shimshon just attacks on his own. Shimshon does not involve the Jews in his attacks on the Plishtim. It could be that that's the style that Yonatan adopts here. Unclear, we just don't know. But what we do know is that when he attacks, he goes clambering up over the rocks, and surprises the Plishtim, it appears. We have different explanations over how exactly it was that he was successful. But fundamentally, he routs the Plishtim, causes a great tumult within the camp. But before he does that, he gets their attention. He calls out to them. And he says to the armor bearer, here's the deal. In the event that the Plishtim respond to my greeting, I suppose, by saying, come on up here, I'm going to take that as a sign that actually we're going to succeed. And in the event that they say, wait there, we're going to come down to you, then I'm going to take that as a sign that we should not, a sign that we should not proceed. He doesn't make this a tefillah. He doesn't word this as a prayer. He simply says, this is going to be our plan. And the question that we started on last time was, why isn't this under the prohibition against nichush, against trying to look for omens? You're looking to see what words they're going to say, and on that basis you're going to act. That would seem to be inappropriate, and that's what we're going to start with today. Ricky.
Excuse me, what language were they speaking? Was there even a
Hebrew? The Jews?
So
the Plishtim? Don't know. Meaning the local Canaanite languages are all similar enough that you can speak in one, and if you have some facility with language, be able to grasp the others. I don't know what language the Plishtim would have spoken. Originally, they're coming from elsewhere. Originally, they come from the area of Greece and Turkey. But at this point, they've been in the land long enough that they ought to be speaking, you know, some local tongue.
Well, they preceded us in our second return after the Mitzrayim. They were already there.
So, yeah, the only question is which group exactly is identified in the Torah as the Plishtim at different times. Is it going based on geography? They inhabit the land that would be owned by the Plishtim. But by now, it's Plishti. Yes, correct. So, at least that as one etymology. So the key to answering the question of what exactly he thought he was doing, first of all, we saw the Gemara last time, right? The Gemara was the one that raised the problem. In other words, I would have just assumed that my assumption would have been that the my assumption.
Not that.
It's fine. It just dinged. The don't worry about it.
I tried to put an airplane mode on.
It's fine. The I would have assumed that what Yonatan was actually doing was perhaps a practical step, as we already talked about, right? We talked about the possibility that it's a practical step. He wants to see how confident the Plishtim are in their position. We offered the idea as well that it was Chizuk, that he's trying to strengthen the spirits of the of this the armor bearer who's with him. That beeping is not from here. That beeping is from somewhere else. Okay, no problem. The Gemara seems to indicate that it's actually prohibited. The Gemara in Chulin is the source of the problem. Because the Gemara in Chulin is talking about, it's a completely different story. It's Rav's story involving the meat that was left unwatched. But in that Gemara, we learn that Nichush attempts to read omens, which is prohibited, is that which is similar to the actions of Yonatan here and Eliezer at the well. That's what's actually prohibited. The definition of a prohibited form of omen reading is what Yonatan did. And that is just, like, I'm flummoxed. Like, how am I supposed to understand this now? I could have explained it easily, if not for the Gemara. Because the Gemara says the prohibited form is just like what Yonatan did. So I don't understand. First of all, Yonatan is good. Second, Hashem helped him, and that's got to count for something. Hashem sometimes helps people who aren't doing good things. But it certainly, the implication is that what Yonatan does is okay. So now I'm just lost. How do you justify it once the Gemara said that it's no good? Everyone understands the problem? The Gemara says the Yonatan sign is the epitome of omen reading that is prohibited. So what is this? So I think in order to answer this question, we have to ask, what exactly is wrong with Nichush in the first place? What's wrong with reading omens? What if I decide that Friday the 13th frightens me? What if I decide that walking under a ladder, black cat crosses my path, whatever silliness people want to invent? So invent it. What's wrong? Why does the Torah say not to do that?
I mean, I think it's just a lack of the moon. Are you supposed to believe God is responsible for everything and everything that happens? And if you attribute it to other causes or your own nonsense, then it's lack of belief.
Right, so one thought which builds on the idea of lack of emunah is not just that it undermines faith in God, but that it actually enables faith in other things. Take a look, please, at the Rambam in source number 1. I brought you the Friedlander translation of the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim. Rambam writes, "When you read the books which I've mentioned to you, you will find that witchcraft, which will be described to you, is part of the customs of the Sabaeans, Kazdim, Chaldeans, and to a higher degree of the Egyptians and Canaanites. They caused others to believe, or they themselves believed, that by means of these arts they would perform wonderful things in reference to an individual person or the inhabitants of a whole country, although no analogy and no reasoning can discover any relation between these performances of the witches and the promised result. In other words, these people claimed that by using various kinds of magical arts, they would be able to cause wondrous results. That's what they did. It is the object and center of the whole law to abolish idolatry and utterly uproot it, and to overthrow the opinion that any of the stars could interfere for good or evil in human matters, because it leads to the worship of stars." In other words, if you start to believe that a black cat is dangerous, you ascribe power to black cats. If you start believing that Friday the 13th is somehow meaningful, then you start to say, what exactly does that mean? Maybe the number 13 has some kind of potency to it. And that affects your loyalty to God. You become loyal to other things, and you start to believe that they have power. Ramban says that as well in source number 2. Ramban says, in his commentary to the Torah's warning about omen reading, he says, "The blessed Creator, when he created everything from nothing, made the upper realms direct the lower realms which are beneath them. The heavens do have control of what happens on earth. And he placed power over the land and all that is in it, in the stars and constellations, according to the direction and gaze upon them, as has been tested by astrology." In other words, he's a believer in the idea of astrology. in those days, if you go back centuries, astrology and astronomy were virtually the same. They, meaning this was considered to be science. We talked about this last time. How the belief was that just like we today understand that there are forces of gravity that are exerted from very far distances from objects of a large mass, so too there are other forces that these planets or whatever it is, based on their orientation in the heavens, are going to bring to bear on the earth below. But the concern is what Ramban writes in number 3, where he says, the Rambam should include in his count of mitzvot the mitzvah of Tamim Tehiyah Im Hashem Elokecha, the mitzvah of believing perfectly in God. The 8th mitzvah, he says, that the Rambam should have included in his list of 613, and he did not, in source number 3, is, we are commanded that our hearts should be complete with God. As it says, you shall be complete with Hashem your God. This command means we should designate our hearts for God alone, and believe that He alone creates all. He is the one who truly knows the future. From Him alone should we seek the future. We should not seek it from those who gaze at the heavens and others, or we should not trust that their words will come true. But if we hear something from them, we should say, Hakol Bidei Shamayim, all is in the hands of heaven. For He changes the arrangement of the stars and constellations at will. It's all under divine control. And Abraham received this command when God came to make a covenant with him and gave him children. God said to him, Hitalech lefanai vehyeh tamim, walk before me and be complete. So this concern, which is seen in the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed, and which is developed by Ramban, is your belief is supposed to be in God. Omens, other things, take you away from God. That's one school of thought. The Rambam has a second school of thought, though. Yeah, Susan.
Am I allowed to say what my commentary says here?
Nope. We're not there yet. No, because I'm trying to build the case.
It uses the Sanhedrin.
I'm not there yet. I'm still not there yet. Right now we're talking about what is involved in Nichush, and then we come back to apply it to our case. If at the end of our discussion of our case, we still haven't said what you've got in the book, you know, chime in. So, source number 4 is the Rambam's other view. He brings you, in the laws of, as you see, Avodah Zarah, idolatry, all of these, all of the different types of magic and sorcery and omens and so forth, he says, are words of falsehood and deception, which the early idolaters used to trick the nations to follow them. And Israel, who are wise and educated, should not follow these matters of emptiness or put the thought into their hearts that these are beneficial. As the Torah says, there is no omen reading in Jacob, no sorcery in Israel. What's the reason not to follow omen reading and so on? What's he saying? Sorry?
Doesn't apply to Israel.
Not just that it doesn't apply to us. What makes it... Sorry?
Nairishkeit.
He said the Nairishkeit. It's a Sephardi word. It means shtuyot. He says we're supposed to be wise and educated people. Therefore, don't follow things that are empty. He doesn't like the picture of a Jew opening up the newspaper and instead of turning to something more serious, turning to the horoscope and saying, I better shape my day based on what Gene Dixon or whoever else, is she a thing in this country? That's the idea. Yes, Ricky. Actually, let me finish the line first and then come back to you. Let me just finish the line first. Anyone who believes in these and similar matters, thinking in his heart they are true and wise and the Torah prohibited them, if you think that omens are actually real, if you think that black cats are actually influential and it's just that God said don't do them, he says, then you're only among the fools and those who lack knowledge. No, it's not. It's her phone. Yes. Okay, Ricky, you were going to say?
Where is this from, this saying?
That's Bilam's bracha to the Jews. Bilam's bracha in Parshat Balak. Kilo nachash b'yako v'lo kesem b'Yisrael.
What parsha is that? Balak?
Balak, yes.
Thank you. Separate thing, but are you allowed to buy a lottery ticket? Is that following?
You are not only allowed; you are encouraged to buy lottery tickets.
Numbers that are, you know, I'm just saying.
Right. No, there's nothing wrong. I mean, there is a separate halachic discussion about whether one is allowed to gamble. And the question of whether buying a lottery ticket is engaging in gambling is an interesting question, which is a little bit beyond the scope of where we're going. No, that's all right. There are two reasons not to gamble. The two basic reasons not to gamble. Number one is that a person who gambles is not engaged in building up the world in a productive way. You're just making money off of some game of chance and taking money from others in order to do so. The second objection is less relevant to a lottery game, more relevant in certain kinds of games of skill, where there's a concern that the people who play this game put their money in the pot. Let's say it's a poker game as an example. They put the money in the pot expecting that they're going to win. They think, I'm smart and I know what I'm doing. And therefore, when you take their money, they haven't given it up. So there's a form of theft involved in that. Less relevant in a game that's clearly purely chance, because everybody knows.
Choosing numbers, let's say, at a roulette table, that's not considered like nichush or anything like that.
So no, it's not a nichush issue.
Lucky,
unless you start really playing like lucky thing. You think this is a lucky thing. Then you end up in omen reading type of territory.
You have your rabbit foot in your pocket.
Exactly. No, bury the rabbit's feet along with the rest of the rabbit. Thanks.
You got it. Couple things. First of all, what's the difference between believing that going under a ladder is bad luck, or putting a red band around your wrist is going to prevent you from having
right.
Bad
so luck. I deliberately didn't bring the red band on example. I don't want to insult people. I don't want to insult people, so I didn't mention the red band. However, if you go to yutara.org, you will find my thoughts on this in the share that I gave on the red strings. Let's just say there may not be a difference.
Okay.
It depends on how you understand where they came from. Yes, Ricky.
So does it mean that we shouldn't be believing in something that could help us? But some people kiss the mezuzah because you think that it's going to protect them. So
kissing the mezuzah is another one that's quite controversial. Kissing a mezuzah is fine. Let me not start with that. The Rambam voiced concern about people who turn the mezuzah into a good luck charm.
It's to protect your house.
Having said that, the Gemara itself seems to present the mezuzah as protection and not only a straight mitzvah. But the Rambam's philosophy is any mitzvah you do protects you. The Gemara also says that. And in that sense, having a mezuzah protects you.
No,
but not that
on is
a mitzvah.
It's a mitzvah. So
correct.
Once you do that.
But not that there's something special about it. In other words, if something terrible happens, Rahmana Litzlan, in a person's family, they shouldn't just say, let me check my mezuzahs. You should check everything that you're doing.
Right.
There's no reason to check a mezuzah specifically. Okay, there's more to be said about that, but also it's not for right now. The bottom line is that you have two concerns. Yes, I actually have a share online also about mezuzah. You can listen to that also.
But
I have two concerns. Concern number one is that believing in omens leads you away from God. And concern number two is foolishness. That is just, this is empty. This has no meaning. Why are you letting this govern your life? It's not the way a Jew should live one's life. So, again, let's go back to our questions that we have regarding Yehonatan. Our questions fundamentally are these. Number one, if this is what the Gemara says is the definition of Nichush, why could he do this? Why was this not a problem? You're violating a prohibition. Number two, if you're going to tell me that Yehonatan actually did something permitted, then why does the Gemara say it's prohibited? Why is the Gemara using it as a template to teach you what not to do if it's really fine to do? And then the third question, which I asked last time, and I think you have to keep in mind with all of this, which is, even if this is permitted, why does Yonatan do this? What is he hoping to gain? What can I learn about Yonatan from the fact that he does this strategy? So the answers that I would provide, all go back to the first approach to why we don't engage in omen reading. Meaning, leaving aside the Rambam's idea, it's foolish, it's meaningless, and so on. The answers tend to focus on this first point, that it leads to idolatry, and there are different approaches that are offered, but they basically are approaches to say, this won't take Yonatan away from God. Doing this is not going to take Yonatan away from God. And yet the Gemara is going to still say that in some way it resembles the prohibition. How? So we have three different approaches. So hold the question.
Yeah, okay.
Because we have three approaches to see. If we still get through those and you still have the question, fine. But we have three different approaches.
They probably agree with you.
The first approach is to say that what Yonatan is doing is like a prohibited form of nichush, in the sense that it is prospective. In the sense that it speaks about a future event. Meaning, there are two different ways in which a person could read omens. One way is to say, before the event, I'm going to be going outside. In the event that it's cloudy, or in the event that there's a black cat, or in the event that there's a ladder, I'm not going to go. I'm going to go back into the house. That's prospective. I am saying, if this happens, then that's going to dictate what I do. As opposed to retrospective. If I say, I'm getting in the car, and then I noticed that there was a black cat outside, or I noticed that there was a ladder. It already happened. I didn't say this is going to be what dictates what I do. And then I say, you know what? I'm going to go back in the house. That is not the prohibited form of nichush. What the Gemara is trying to say is that the nichush that is prohibited is when you identify a sign before it takes place, because that shows your mentality is one of looking for signs, as opposed to, you know, that happened, now I have a bad feeling, I'd rather not go. That's not viewed as a prohibited form of nichush. What Yonatan did was, exactly, in that sense, Yonatan resembles what nichush looks like, but for him, it's not the same. And the reason it's not the same is because he's not doing it for the sake of nichush. What he's doing it for, and I mentioned this before briefly, is for practical benefit. Which is, he wants them to feel good. He wants his armor bearer to feel confident that they're going to succeed. Take a look at Radak in source number 5. You'll see it there. In the interest of simplifying things, I'm just going to read my English translation, but you have the original Hebrew there as well. If one wishes to perform a deed, there's something you want to do, and he does one thing as a sign for that deed in order to strengthen his heart and awaken his heart toward that action, this is permitted. If you do something just to make yourself feel confident that things are going to work out, that's okay. This is what we do on Rosh Hashanah, right? That's one explanation for why it's okay to have certain sweet foods or foods with a certain message in their names. It's chizuk. It makes you feel good. That's all it is. It's not dictating what the year is going to be like. Therefore, this is actually okay. Had Eliezer and Yehonatan been sinning in this, Radak says, God would not have answered them properly, helping their deeds. The Talmudic statement by Rav, when Rav says that what Yonatan did is the model for a prohibition, means the following. Any nachash and sign, which one does not perform a sign for himself, which one does not, that's funny. In which one performs a sign for himself from... Well, it's... No, I mean, the problem is that the Talmud, as we saw last week, words it in a double negative. And that's why this English is so warped. I'm trying to mirror the Gemara's form. Any nachash and sign in which... It should have in which, really. In which one does not perform a sign for himself from the start, as Eliezer and Yonatan did, is not a nachash and sign. Or to state the opposite, or to simplify the double negative, nachash is problematic if it is prospective. That's really what the Gemara is trying to say. Not that what Eliezer and Yonatan did was wrong. They did a prospective act, but it wasn't for the sake of reading omens. Yonatan was not looking at this as, if the Plishtim say this, now there's some kind of supernatural power or whatever it is. He was just trying to establish something which would give his armor-bearer confidence. And he says, one should not rely on it or be concerned for it if it should happen on its own. If the event takes place, it takes place. So in other words, what Radak is trying to tell you, and this is similarly seen in the Raivad on the Rambam, in the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam, is that what Yehonatan did was not a religious act. What Yehonatan did was not a reliance on superstition. It was simply a military strategy. He wants to get his soldiers, or in this case, soldier, going. And he's rallying him, and he says, if they say something that we want to hear, we're going to go for it. Mm-hmm. right? And lo and behold, they said something you want to hear. Great, let's go. Does he know that they're going to say this? Because he figures that's likely what they're going to say. They're going to say, come on up, right? And therefore, this is all just shtick. Possibly. The question really is, how would the story have gone if they didn't say what he wanted them to say? Would he have said, all right, let's wait till tomorrow? And the answer is maybe. What?
But it's still yeah.
But no, but now he doesn't have the good feeling, mm-hmm. right?
But he didn't say exactly what they have to say for yeah. him to feel good about.
Yeah, he did.
He did?
Yeah, no, he said that explicitly. Go back to the wording. Okay. Pasuk Chet. Pasuk Tet, I should say. Perek Yedaleh Pasuk Tet, chapter 14, sentence 9. Im ko yomru eleinu, if they say this to us, domu ad hagienu aleichem, be silent until we arrive at you, then amadnu tachteinu, we're just going to stay, we're not going anywhere. Velo na'ale aleichem, we're not going to attack. Vim ko yomru, and if they say this, alu aleinu, come up to us, then ve'alinu, then we're going to go. He's very specific about it. He doesn't even account for the possibility of them saying something else, which Nanette pointed out last time. We have to come back to that. Toby, and then Leona. Yeah.
Well, it's not like he says, if a heart-shaped cloud appears, we will do. What he knows there's going to be communication from the Pushtim.
Yes.
So he knows it's either going to be one way or the other way. That's what makes it a military strategy.
That's
and not
right.
a push.
Right. It's relevant to what's going on here. It's not just a random thing. Correct. Agreed. Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of corroborate what Toby's saying. Basically, what the Beforshim are missing is that Yonatan is a military man. And he used military strategies and tacticians. So he obviously knows the implications of what, if they say those words, he knows the Plishtim well enough and what's happened with the Plishtim in previous occasions to know what is implied with that, which would give him an opportunity to win.
Right.
So, I don't see this as Nechosh at all.
And that's what the commentators are trying to tell you. They're not missing it. They're not missing this at all.
No, but I just don't think it's only to make his bearer feel good. I think there was definitely some
reason. So what you're with, hang in there, is the Ron. We're not there yet.
Okay.
That's the Ron. We're not quite there yet. Susan and then Ricky.
So at this point, he was ready now to fight, because we had said he was
he said
to test. Right. But now he's changed his tactic. We aren't there to test anymore. We're there to fight, to win.
What do you mean? No, I'm missing what you're saying.
At the beginning, we said when he first went out, we didn't know if one of the reasons he went was just to see what was going on.
No, that was before. We did say when there's a clear transition of intent, even within Malbim, that once he gets there, he is now looking at doing more. That's already in that's clear at this point. He intends to do that. Yeah, no, that is clear. Yes, Ricky.
I had two thoughts. For one thing, it's like flipping a coin. Maybe he didn't know what she wants to do, and he said, "Well, if it this does, then I will do this." The other thought is that he wanted to give the police team the idea that they're in control, so that whatever they say, he reacts to. But at the same time, as you said, he already knows the implications.
I mean, the police team don't know about this gamble that he's doing with the armor bearer. The police team aren't aware of this conversation.
They're not, but he knows they're there. They see him.
Yeah.
And it gives them a sense of power because they are the one who are about to suggest either or to say come up or else they come up. It gives them a sense of power.
But again, they don't know the story. In other words, the police don't just see this Yonatan, who they may know is the prince and they may not, standing down there, down below, with his armor bearer, which probably gives them a clue. If you have an armor bearer and you have armor, that already means something. But the Plishtim just hear him say, "Hi, here I am," and then they respond. I mean, they feel they have a position of power anyway. They're holding the high ground. They're the invaders. All the Jews are hiding in their holes. I think the Plishtim have a pretty good sense of being in control. I don't see this as adding to that. Maybe, but I want to move to the second and third answers because there's so much to talk about here. similar, the second approach, I'm sorry, is to say that what Yonatan is doing is similar to Nihush in the sense that he is willing to rely on this to determine what he's going to do. One of the hallmarks of omen reading is that you take the omen seriously. If a person says, you know, I'm about to go on the road. I'm going either way. But I know it's going to be a good day if the if it's, you know, I don't want to use really the meteorology examples, the cloudy and not cloudy, because those have practical relevance. But if the person says, if there's another car on the road and it's a blue car, you know, that's going to make me feel good. If I know, if I see that two cars like mine are on the road with me, then I'm going to feel good about this. I'm going anyway. But it's just, if I see it, I'll feel good. That's not nichush. That's not nichush at all. Nichush is, if you say, if this happens, then I'm doing it. And if this doesn't happen, or it happens differently, then I'm not doing it. In that sense, what Yonatan is doing is like nichush. However, the Ran says, what Yonatan does is okay, is acceptable, because what he's doing is fundamentally picking up on something of practical relevance. And this goes back to what Leona was trying to say, I think. Take a look at source number 6 and you'll see the run. This is his approach. He says, the Nachash prohibited by the Torah is when one makes his affairs hinge on a sign which should not logically cause benefit or harm to his affairs. For example, if his bread falls from his mouth, right? He's eating and he says, if my bread falls from my mouth, I guess I shouldn't go. Or a deer crosses his path. But one who takes signs for something where logic dictates that the sign would indicate benefit or harm in the matter, the sign is actually of practical relevance. That is not nachash. For all the world's affairs are thus. Right? You say, I'm only going to cross the street if the light is green. That's clearly not nachash. Right? That's hopefully what you do. Right? And the white signal there also. Right? That's a good point. If one says, he picks on the meteorology. He says, if one says, if it rains, I won't go. If not, I will go. That's not nachash. That's the way of the world. Yonatan ben Shaul sought to strike the Plishti camp, him and his armor bearer alone. And he took this as a sign for himself. Should they say, ascend to us, it would appear they fear an ambush. Yeah. Right? And that shows that that they have some level of fear, some level of lack of confidence. Yeah?
I think this is a great answer, but how do we explain, what is it, the Gemara that says that they're the prime example of Nihush?
Right, because the idea of depending on it mm-hmm. is what makes it like Nihush. The model of Nihush is when you take the omen and say, this is something that that I'm going to decide yay or nay based on this. That's a hallmark of Nihush, which they have also. But theirs is okay because what they're picking is a practical point.
Okay.
So what this is really about is fundamentally trying to figure out what the salient characteristics of Nihush are and what makes it Nihush and what makes it not Nihush. So right now we have two different lessons, right? And the first lesson that we took from Radak is that Nihush is only prospective if it's setting the sign beforehand. And then the second one is that Nihush is only problematic if this is really going to determine what you do. Clear? Then we have the third approach. This approach is brought by the Torah Tamima, and I'm glad to see it in the Torah Tamima, because I would have thought this answer was the obvious answer to put pay to everything. I haven't seen anyone earlier say it. Maybe it was just obvious to everybody. I don't know. Yonatan mentioned the name of Hashem. Right? Go back to the Pasuk again. Right?
Yeah.
He says, in the event that they say, ascend to us, we're going to go. Why? Because Hashem put them in our hands. This is a tefillah.
Right.
This is a prayer. Davening is not nichush. You're relying on God. It's similar to nichush in the sense that you are relying on it, like the Ran said. You're relying on this symbol, but you're not really relying on the symbol. You're relying on God. This is a religious act, fundamentally. And that fits with the approach which we mentioned last week from Abarbanel, from Rabag, from Malbim, that what Yehonatan is doing, like Eliezer at the well, is looking for God to put these words into the mouths of the plishtim. That's what he wants. Eliezer and Yonatan are doing exactly what Nichush is. The only difference is that they're appealing to God to do it instead of appealing to some foreign force. That's the difference. Take a look on your sheet, please, at the Torah Tamima, Baruch Levi Epstein, in source number 7. He says, any nichush, which one does not actually depend upon to act on it, like Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, as is seen in the portion, does not involve a prohibition against nichush. And then he says, it appears clear in this matter that in truth, the only nichush which is prohibited is when one links the nichush to the event itself. I should have just started from it appears. Without mentioning God's name and without asking God for aid in causing that event. Then it appears to involve magic. It's prohibited if this isn't about Hashem. Clear? Yeah.
It's very interesting that Rav took those two examples which are not nechush, just example, and he didn't find, and actually made it necessary, didn't do nechush.
Kilonachan
Biyakov.
Yes. Right. It's true. Like, it would have been good if Rav could have given us, like, an actual case of Nichush to hold up as an example of what you shouldn't do. Instead of giving us two cases in Tanakh, which are somewhat similar to Nichush, but actually are not Nichush to work from.
Does Eliezer use Hashem's name? He does then, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. He absolutely does. So, we have three different views of what Yonatan was doing here. Susan, last week you had mentioned Tosfos and Chulin was in your pink book, so they side with Radak as well. They take that first approach. So to make sure that we're somewhat clear on this, because I realize that we've gotten far away at this point from the storyline. But Yonatan is ready to attack. Yonatan says, either I want a step of encouragement here, and so I'm going to ask for that encouragement, and if I get it, then we're going to go. And that's a fine thing for Yonatan to do. However, if you do it not for encouragement, but just omen reading, then it will be a problem. That's one take. Second approach, Yonatan was looking for something positive, but in a practical way. He's looking for something, a practical sign that this is a good thing to do. He's looking for the plishtim to say, we're afraid of an ambush, so we want you to come up here, because that's more secure for us. And that's an okay thing for him to do. What would not be okay is if he was relying on a sign that was not of practical relevance. That's the second approach, that's the run. And then the third approach, the Torah Tamima, who says, no, what he's doing is he's appealing to Hashem, and he's saying, Hashem, please give me a sign that this is an okay thing to do. If they say this, I'm going to take that as a sign from you that we should go put our lives on the line in this way. But otherwise, we're not going to do it. That's the third approach. But here's the last point on this issue. Again, I asked before, what does this tell us about Yonatan? If I take the approach of Radak, that what Yonatan is looking for is a psychological boost, or I take the approach of the Ran, that it's a military tactic. So, Yonatan fundamentally is a savvy tactician. Right? He's going to make this move against the Plishtim, and he wants to make sure either that he has read them right, as the Ran says, or that his armor bearer isn't going into this quaking and feeling like they're already dead. However, you could also read this the third way to show that Yonatan is a pious person. Right, that Yonatan is looking for Hashem and expects Hashem to give him a sign like this. Hashem is actually putting these words in their mouths as a sign to him. That fits very well with where we started this story. Yonatan killing the Plishti in the first place, right? The first Plishti who he killed, right? And we said that Hashem may be inspiring him with Ruach HaKodesh, driving him forward here. Yonatan is an agent of God. And so it makes sense that his attack now is going to be subject to Hashem. He could have had an easier way of doing this, which would have been just ask the Urim V'Tumim, right, that they had in the camp. Like, why did you have to do it this way? But that's what he is doing. And now that he succeeded, and he routed the 20, he killed 20 Plishtim in his attack, and the whole Plishti camp is in a tumult, now the shoe is on the other foot. The Jews had been afraid, The Jews were all panicked. Hang on. The Jews were all panicked and they were running to hide for the nearest hole, right? And now instead, the Plishtim are the ones who are afraid and the Jews are ready to rally. Yes, Susan.
We wouldn't, he could, if we have the feeling that he only wanted the bearer to know for attack or for whatever reason, then he couldn't ask the Ori Maturi because everybody would know and that would
yes. No, that's true. That's true. No, I'm just pointing out that it's funny that he skipped the Urim Batumim.
But that's
which
why.
Is not, yeah, no, but there are a lot. We could give explanations. It all based on, it all depends on how we understand why he decided to go it alone. That's really what this comes down to. But I agree with you. That will be correct. Okay, that wraps the Nichush issue.